The banana skin is waiting for you around the corner anyway, and you don't know where it is.
Absolute right, 150, unseen easy right, 50, easy left, 50 grid, 100, oh dear God.
Are you going to sustain your third place now, or are you going to try and attack Stig, or what?
Well, tomorrow? Oh, come on, really, you really knew the answer to that question before you asked. I mean, we cannot let Swede to finish in front of Finn Canby in Finland. We can't. It would be a big embarrassment, so I'm sorry.
I was trying a little bit too hard. I got a little bit too enthusiastic. I was trying to decide the whole rally on one stage, and so I had to pay for it. But luckily, we got it.
Are you resigned to the fact that this new Peugeot then is just too fast for the Audi?
No, I only know that Audi is too fast for me.
In life you can lift your hand but not your foot.
Hello and welcome to a very special episode of the Spring Podcast. And it is our great pleasure to welcome along not only one of rallying's biggest heroes, or even one of motorsport's biggest heroes, but one of the greatest sportsmen in history, full stop. So we have 1981 World Rally Champion, multiple Dakar winner and former MEP, Ari Vatanen. Ari, welcome along.
Thank you and hello to everybody in Ireland. I'm touched that you contacted me because there's some certain particular bonding between Finland and Ireland. That is true for many. We are small countries next to some big countries who haven't always treated us, not you, not us, very well. So there's some bonding. I always loved my time in Ireland. So good to be with you sincerely. And you know, when Finn says it, this is not an American statement. This is a proper statement.
Good to hear. Obviously, Ari, like you've had some great events in Ireland, particularly in your early days, but can you just maybe take us through how things started off for you?
So I try to cut the long story short, which is not easy. So many things have happened. And it's true that myself, sometimes I really do wonder sincerely that it's incredible how my life has unfolded. And very rightly so, I asked that, you know, why me? Why have I had this incredible privilege to see my life unfolding the way it has? Why somebody else? I haven't done anything to deserve it. But anyway, so I was born in the eastern part of Finland, Karelia, next to the Russian border. Oldest of the four kids. And 1960, my father managed to follow his long-standing dream, bought his very first motor car. Is a Borgward, German car, Borgward Isabella. Because he wanted to buy Citroën DS19, but it was not available in Finland at that time. And then a few months later, we go to a funeral in a nearby village, the entire family. My sister I was 8, she was 6, then Mariana was 5, and Tatu was 6, my youngest brother, 4. So between 4 years, and just before we come to the village, we have a head-on collision and my father dies. An incredible thing is that he had installed, it just sounds too incredible to be true, but that's how it was. He had, in the previous day, he was a very avant-garde person. At that time, seatbelts were not original equipment, and he had installed on the previous day, 2-point seat belts. They were 2-point at that time, just across the chest. But they were not buckled. They were not fitted well. I mean, he did not use them at all in order, my mother. who were in the front seats, and he died. He hit his head on a steering wheel and he died on that accident. And then even more incredible is that my mother realized then afterwards that we were not on the right day. That funeral had taken place on the previous day. For some reason, my parents had been mistaken by the date of the funeral of their friend. So suddenly, we have no father, no car. And I had apparently said afterwards at some point that I will tame a motor car in my life. So maybe my rest of my life now, which is now, that's for 60 years ago, exactly. My father died exactly now, 60 years ago, because I'm now 68. So maybe this following 60 years I've been trying to tame a motor car. And man, if there's a one sentence to be kept from this interview is that what I learned that yes, you can tame a motor car, but you can't tame life. Life will tame us. Life will tame us. It's that way around. So so you may be a champion, you may be famous, you may be this and that, but in fact, finally, we are just little clowns in the circus of life. And anyway, from then on, we had no car, no father. And then 4 years later, when I was 12 years old, rally came for the first time ever to my home village. Even you know now of Tupovaara. I'm sure you have Googled it. It's close to Russian border. So rally came for the first time ever. 2 o'clock in the morning in the middle of June. And I said, just to remind you, in the middle of June in Finland, it's a nightless night. There's practically no night. It's fabulous, this fabulous light. And the first guy came 2 o'clock in the morning. So when the rest of the family went to bed 10 o'clock in the evening, I took my bicycle and pedaled to the few kilometers away on a downhill tightening left-hand corner, because obviously it was non-regid event. And I had figured out that on the, you know, some cars could be, you know, drivers could be caught out and tightening the left-hand corner. And there I was then 10 o'clock, 4 hours before the first car. And when the first car came, you know, a white Volvo 544, you know, drum brakes were hot, kicking up the dust in that beautiful Finnish summer light. And I'm sitting there on a bank and, you know, my soul, my mind went in that car and my body stayed on that bank. And literally the rest of the story, you know, that is the starting point. And everything else after that is in a way result of that night, result of those dreams, which were my dreams, my unique dreams. And I never challenged, because had I tried to figure out if they are feasible, of course, not, they are not feasible. But I was like a little beetle. They say aerodynamically, a beetle, you know, most of the beetles, they can fly. I mean, there are, by the way, over 3,000 different species of beetles in Finland, I'm sure, same in Ireland. You never knew there are so many different species, and very many of them can fly. And they say aerodynamically, if you look at the weight of the beetle and the size of its wings and so forth, and the speed it flaps them, you know, beetle cannot fly. Luckily, beetle doesn't know it, and he flies. Well, my life has been like that. I didn't know that I can fly, but I just flew. So that gives you the forces which have been pushing me forward, no calculation, no thinking, because if you had analyzed, the result would have been zero. It's not; it cannot be done. But luckily, dreams are much stronger than any mathematical equation. You used to run after them, and all my life I've been running after them, and that's it.
So just purely natural sort of drive, so to progress. Like, I suppose the sport was quite a bit different back then to what it is now. And if you look at, you know, the progression from the start of your career up to, we'll say, the late 70s, where you were, you know, a factory driver for Ford. How was that transition for you to go to the UK as a young guy?
It's a big, very big learning curve, steep, thrown into steep end of the pool. And and barely able to swim. But it was not only driving-wise, it was life-wise. I mean, everything is new. Everything was a novelty. It was an incredible thing. It was like, you know, poor film that, you are amateur actor in a little amateur theater in Tupovaara, and somebody calls from Beverly Hills, they'll come and act in a big film. It just normally doesn't happen, but that's what did happen. So I did the Velsali, I 75, because John Thomas had written to me and said, well, take me as a co-driver. And I have 300, local Opel garage will give 300 quid. And that's at the strength of that 300 pound sponsorship. We put Opel Ascona, my battered Opel Ascona on a boat and came to the Velsali 75, where I did, reasonably well. And then Opel, I got Tony Fall gave me a service for the Scottish Sally 75. Then I got, Ford lent me Timo Mäkinen's, works escort, just a car, no service, nothing for the Thousand Lakes. And, I was unknown. And after five stages, I was leading the Thousand Lakes Sally. It's like in a poor film, if you write a script like that, it's not true. But in those days, it was possible. Today, it's not possible anymore. Everything has become so sophisticated, so expensive. The learning curve is very long now. At that time, you could, with your own car, you could sometimes do the fastest times because you knew the roads better and some world stars knew, which was my case. So you could make your name known suddenly and you could make yourself noticed much easier. So I come as an unknown guy to Velsali 75. Then Stuart Turner gave me, although I, of course, went off the road in Thousand Lakes. He gave me an escort for the RAC 75. And I can never forget that when I come to Boreham. And Boreham is that's what Beverly Hills is for actors. Well, Boreham was for a young rally driver from the forest in the eastern part of Finland. And there were three brand new escorts there in a Boreham workshop. One for famous Timo Mäkinen, one for Roger Clark, and third had my name on it. So I had to really, pinch myself. Is it really me? I mean, how is this true? And anyway, so I after first day, I think I was third or fourth, which was very surprisingly good. On the second day, we had with Peter Bryant, who very sadly now very recently passed away, Peter. He's had a big accident, I think it was Clipston Forest, very similar to my accident in Argentina, where I very nearly died. It was a long, long straight and a big kind of a hole on the road, and most of the drivers knew of it, but we didn't, and we had a massive accident. And I was absolutely sure that that's it. That's the end of, I was given a golden opportunity by Stuart Turner. So would you believe, even the jump card came off escort. So I took it actually with me and I carried it out of the forest, kind of a proof that I will try to desperately prove to Mr. Turner that look at, it's not completely my fault that that hole was such a big hole and it was on a straight line. And then to my surprise, Stuart Turner said to me, okay, Ari, let's start living in Britain and in Chelmsford, and you will do British Championship. So that's how it all, so between Wales 75 and the RAC, that was half a year. And from unknown guy, I became a works driver. So it couldn't happen in these days anymore. And then to answer your question, I mean, it was just a big, fantastic time. Everything was new to me. I was learning life. I was learning driving to the maximum attack all the time. Plenty of bent body cells, and Ford was very forgiving. And our spectators loved it. And this fair-haired guy from Finland, whatever. It was a bit of a fairy tale story. It was a bit of a fairy tale story.
You competed in Ireland in several occasions this period. And you won in Donegal and Cork in 78, as well as doing the Circuit of Ireland and the Ulster. obviously, this is all in around the time you were doing the British Championship. What was your impression of the level of competition and the atmosphere at events you can be at here in Ireland?
Yeah. I was going to mention, you know, on my previous answer, was of course the very first, summer at 75. Obviously it must have been Tony Fall who organized it. So we did the Donegal with David Richards 75, and that was of course. I don't even remember anymore. It was just before the Scottish or after the Scottish. It may have been after the Scottish 75. But anyway, the Welsh, the Scottish, and the Donegal, they were all in one row, and incredible opportunities for me. I remember like a little instance, German driver Achim Warenbold was there in the BMW. John Davenport was his co-driver. And of course, Donegal was a recce event, but I didn't really know how to make special notes. And on top of that, with English, with David Richards. So I remember them coming the other way, and John Davenport asked, "How do you work out your English space notes?" So I didn't even really know what does mean work out something. I just said yes, nodding head, yes. And I don't even remember what happened in that rally. I mean, did we must have finished, and I think we may have, bent a car and knocked some, stones down off the walls. But what did happen was that during the recce, the local Opel dealer, it was Doherty, whatever his name was, Doherty.
Exactly.
He had given his wife's private car as a recce car. And I went out with the mechanic one evening and I went past the junction. I don't know why. I still remember the junction. I went past the junction and so I just reversed flat out, turned the steering wheel, flipped the steering wheel and braked, and I thought the front end would just slide around, but on tarmac it didn't. We rolled it. So that was the only car I have rolled the car while I was reversing, and the Opel dealer wasn't particularly happy. So it was that kind of a event, and I remember there were some nice Irish, we were dancing somewhere. I remember whether it was a bonfire or not, but I remember there was some kind of outside discotheque or similar to, in many ways it was, young man learning life and incredible memories. And you mentioned the atmosphere. I mean, Irish atmosphere is renowned for being very, very friendly, very brotherhood-like, the spirit is very, very good. And so I always felt that, of course, I laid on a cork and, so I've always felt very comfortable, let alone the, of course, Circuit of Ireland, which wasn't always so comfortable driving-wise, because it was a very big event. And when I think afterwards that how fast we were pushing, and of course, my dear friend Billy Coleman, he must have known some of the roads, and also Jimmy McGrave must have known some of the stages, but I knew nothing. And when you are driving fast tarmac roads on a night time and you go over the brow and you have no idea what's behind it, just open, you just see it's all open. It may go straight, most of the time it goes straight, but not always. I remember how we're pushing to the limit, and of course I don't think I did a single Irish event, let alone Circuit of Ireland, that I would not have bent a car for sure. But they were very colourful, and that's what life is all about.
I think it's fascinating for us to look back on, because obviously like none of us were even alive when the circuit was in its heyday, so we only hear the stories and watch the videos and stuff like that. And your point you made there, that it's very difficult to escape 5 days of a circuit without any damage, and you'd see damage on a car on the second stage, and trying to it's just so fascinating to imagine that a rally can take in so much. And Exactly. And still consider without pace notes how fast you guys were pushing and stuff. It was just a different time.
Another thing, you know, at that time, because of course Circuit of Ireland was just during the Easter time, and there was this famous saying that all the Irish girls will come to Killarney. I don't know what it was this, but I remember, Ari, you go to Killarney, you know, all the Irish girls will be in Killarney. Well, I never saw them, but I may have seen some of them. I can't remember. But anyway, I remember this kind of sentence that, oh, Harry, you don't know what Circuit of Ireland is like, you know. it's driving and partying. And now I remember, I think actually Donegal start one morning. That must have been not 75 edition, but I think 78 edition when I did it again with Peter Bryant, now with late Peter Bryant, my good friend. In that famous Black Escort. The start was delayed one morning because I think that if the drivers were put in the breathalyzer test and the alcohol test, they would not have passed it. So the start was delayed by 1 hour in the morning. So can you imagine that saying to FIA, well, why was the start delayed by 1 hour? Well, the drivers were not yet sober. We had to all wait. I mean, so having lived and seen all that, I mean, what can you say? It's just golden memories, golden, not just driving wise, but memories of life.
It must have been crazy for 5 days, you know, on tarmac, you know, without power steering. And it was something we were only discussing at breakfast this morning. Budgets were good in those days, but maybe not so good to have 3 or 4 race suits. Just the practicalities of, was it just one race suit for 5 days?
Probably. And of course, and probably one underwear also. So I don't even, could have had maybe 2, but you're totally right. I mean, come on, unless it was really necessary, I don't think we changed the suit. I don't think so. But I mean, it was rallying at its purest form, and even think about organizing a long event like that. You know, according to today's standards, you wouldn't have a manpower. You wouldn't simply have a manpower to organize an event like that, and security-wise also throughout the night, how close to the closest ambulance, so I have no idea. So, you know, but I'm so happy that I have seen it now, that when it was not so professional.
Yeah, I think, Ari, like, and that probably a lot of the reason why rallying became so big in this country was because of that time, because it was so accessible for everyone. Because, you know, you talk to somebody who maybe hasn't had an interest in rallying for 30 years, but they will remember seeing you guys pass their front gate in, you know, late 70s, early 80s. And they can say, if we, you know, it's amazing. Even now, you can say to someone, you know, 60, 70 years old, they will know Billy Coleman straight away. Billy Coleman is still, to most people, absolutely. Ari Vatanen, Marco Allen, Hannah Mikkola, all these guys, Jimmy McRae, these guys who came over, you know, they are still the ultimate guy, the ultimate rally drivers, which I think it's amazing, you know, after so much time. But it was really special. I suppose looking towards the end of the 70s, and the situation with Ford changed. The Boreham team sort of pulled away, and you ended up with the David Sutton, and then you won your first WRC rally, the Acropolis, in 1980, and then immediately then the year after the championship. So, what was the situation like there?
Yes, it's you know, of course, I had thrown so many wins out of the window. I mean, when you and my first event on a continent, apart from the Thousand Lakes, was Portugal Rally 77. And even that, okay, later on when I was an MEP, I couldn't help but remember how poor Portugal was 1977. Well, I mean, in that matter, most of the European countryside were quite poor. But of course, Portugal particularly, because they had this kind of a dictatorship, and they only had 74, the revolution. And they went into a democracy. Anyway, I was leading that Portuguese rally. I was leading it. And then I had some puncture. And again, I went past Björn Valdegård and all these top names. And I went off the road in Portugal on a 10-kilometer-long special stage. After the flying finish, I had not paid attention. There was still 1K left after the flying finish. And I went over the road 77. And I still had, I remember, I was 10 seconds faster than anybody on a 10-kilometer stage. But then I went off the road after the flying finish. I had so many similar events like that. So then finally, but luckily Ford was so forgiving. So luckily, I did not win a single round until 1980. And it became a kind of a pressure on me already that, you know, will I remain like forever a hopeful, but never materialized the hopes which were pinned on me. And then suddenly in the following year, I won the championship. So in a way, it became nearly too early. But of course, championships at that time were not like today. I mean, we took part in the events we happened to have money for. And so we didn't do all the rounds, nor did other teams. But anyway, I said very often to Max afterwards that there's no way I could have had a career now if I was born 1990. You know, I was very lucky in that sense. It was so much easier in those days. Today, it's so much more professional and tougher and of course, so much more expensive. Cars were very simple at that time. You know, Mick Jones, our infamous floors of manager, Mick Jones from Boreham, now late Mick Jones, he said in his very strong, I don't know, is it a Cockney accent, but anyway, whatever broke down in the Escort, let's beef it up. That's how you did it. We welded another piece of metal on top of the previous one, and that's it. Let's beef it up.
Yeah.
So, and like an Escort, I mean, it was really simple car, apart from the very beautiful engine, but the rest was very primitive. So it was very cheap, and then that's why accessible, and also as I said earlier, even nobody from nowhere could make his name known much easier than now. So 81, of course, it was very typical of my career. The last round RAC, I was still behind Guy Fregelin, having gone off the road too many times during the year. And so we had to finish the rally and we had to finish in front of Guy Fregelin. And finally we made it. Guy Fregelin went off the road. Hanno Mikkola won the rally, and we beat in a four-wheel drive quattro. And I remember during the rally, he became really angry. He had seen my driving marks, you know, close to ditch. He said, "Ari, those are not the marks of this year's world champions. So slow down, don't be crazy." And we won that event finally. There's one photo, which was taken at the end of the very final special stage. So we only had the road section to do, Chester. Mm-hmm. But that relief at the, you know, David Sutton is hugging me and we hug each other, and the relief on our faces that, wow, we finally managed to hold it together, because particularly with me driving, I was not, you know, Alain Prost or Walter Röhl, you know, very systematic and thinking. I was the pure passion took over too many times, and the rational thinking got forgotten. So then you end up with a very colorful career, but of course sometimes very frustrating career also, because like in Portugal 81. I was leading by 6 minutes and I went off the road because I just was thinking, oh, we are going to lead the world championship. And then I went off the road. The following stage, when the previous Audi had retired, all the Audis were out, and suddenly I was alone in the front anyway. And the first few corners following stage, I went off the road. And it's a little anecdote on that Portugal, which I still stands out in my mind. So I drive, you know, with a throat in my, with a heart in my throat, all the way down to Lisbon. Rita is waiting with Ria. With Ria, Ria was what, 1 year at that time, and I come like 2-3 o'clock in the morning on the hotel door, and you know, really broken man, and let down everybody down, and there was a little note on the hotel door. Rita had glued on the outside that, Ari, I love you. Together we are strong, you know. Yeah. There are things which are sticking out in my mind like that, like a frozen frames of the film in life. And yeah. That's very important too.
But that was a very tough year. Just looking at the rallies, you guys, you know, considering that David Sutton Cars, you're essentially a private team, and it's, you know, so far removed from what we see nowadays, and especially with, you know, okay, maybe you had the Escort, which was that bit more simple to work on and stuff like that, and reliable and stuff, but still, you guys went to the Acropolis, you went to Argentina, Brazil, even the Ivory Coast during that year, which was, you know, when you think about it now, and the difference of those events compared to the, I suppose, the more European sprint type events, you know, to the challenge must have been a lot greater, I think, than maybe some of what we see now. What do you think?
Yeah, definitely. And even logistically thinking, you know, David Sutton had a little workshop in Acton, in the middle of London. A little tiny workshop. And then, of course, we had freelance mechanics and borrowed some other service vans. But it was a very tiny operation. But that spirit, of course, the spirit was there. And then to do rallies like Argentina and Portugal, let alone that Ivory Coast, because when you look at the photos of Ivory Coast event, when we had an accident with the oncoming lorry in the beginning of the rally, and a car was in a terrible shape. I don't know how we actually managed to. I remember we came to service halt in Ivory Coast. We were really tired, and the car was hardly moving. And it was supposed to be a 7-hour service rest. And when we come to the halt, we see Timo Salonen leaving. They were so far in the front, so we were like a half a day behind them. half a day behind them. But that was a rallying of those days. And of course, we were against Fiat team and of course, even against Audi. I mean, it was definitely the David against, literally David Sutton, David against Goliath. Yeah. And finally, I suppose we had the winning spirit, I suppose, finally, yes.
I think one great, I suppose, example of the Escort and how different things were back then. There's a famous video I'm sure a lot of our listeners will have seen from the Scottish in 1976, I think.
That's 76.
Where you have the differential. Yeah. What was the story there?
And that is a real film. And even when I look at that film, I speak my English. I had a better accent 76 than now. I was surprised by my English. I saw that film only a little while ago again. But anyway, it's all true. You know, I'm so relaxed, and Tony Fall is asking my stage times, and I'm saying to Tony Fall, "But don't you understand? You know, we don't have an accent. We don't have a diff." And then flagging down a 3-liter Capri. And amusing thing is there was an elderly couple in that 3-liter Capri, and you know, hardly they had stopped, and the poor lady at the back, you know, she didn't realize what's going on. When they just told the driver that, well, by the way, we are going to take your axle, and that poor lady was sort of, you know, the leaning forward when the back of the Capri was up, and she didn't understand what on earth is going on. And before she realized, she was still on her seat. I think the back axle was being dropped off, and can you imagine that? Now you cannot, if you give a drinking bottle of water to a driver in a non-service area, I mean, you are excluded from the event.
Exactly. Yeah, it's just so alien.
That's also why people, although it was not Group B, but that kind of spirit was in a Group B also. Wild things, wild, maybe not also so reasonable things did happen. And that explains why people because now today everything's so controlled, you know, governments and authorities, and I'm not an anarchist, far from it, but of course, man needs some freedom also. Man needs some liberty, because if you haven't got the liberty, we all are different, there are not two persons alike. And man needs liberty in order to develop, in order to push humanity forward. We need liberty. And under false pretext of trying to have a safe life, everything is forbidden and controlled and authorized. And we can throw a child with the bathwater when we behave like that. But you know, Group B and also was that, you know, it was maybe unreasonable, went too far. But I mean, it gave wings to the dreams of people. Those cars, those monstrous cars, they were beasts. And that's why people speak to me every other day. Somebody speaks about Group B, because that kind of spectacular cars and event, they make them to forget the daily worries and lift them above this daily gray monotonous routine. And we need that. We need entertainment in life, and we need circus in life, and we need clowns in life, and we need freedom in life. And if there are no risks, there's no progress. You know, we need to take risks. And when we see we go too far, we come back. But there's no progress without risks in life. Whether you look at penicillin or any inventions, they have happened because people take risks.
Yeah.
And that's why mankind will survive now, in particularly in these days when people are so negative, and of course we have a pandemic, and but we must be hopeful, and we must look, lift our heads and look further ahead, and man will overcome his problems always. Yeah,
I think it's your point there, Ari. It's actually really nice to hear you using the term freedom there, back in a time when things were a bit more relaxed and there was, as you say, a more free approach. And even Morris's comment there about the memories people have of the early days back in Ireland and the British Championship, or even like older relatives of mine would have the same memories and they wouldn't be motorsport fans. So it kind of maybe captured people a lot more, but it's just nice to hear that analogy looking back on it, because it's definitely something I'd see as well, looking back at the time when obviously we weren't even alive. But I suppose moving forward into 82, obviously you have the world title and returning to Opel, where you joined Henry Toivonen. How did that come about when you moved into Opel there? Was there any link with Dave Richards in that thing getting moved?
No, that was end of 80. It was 82. I was driving this MCD or Escort, and later on they changed the team, the private team. But I just did British Championship and Finland in a Milk sponsored car. But then RAC 82, I went to a Opel team. I can't remember if David was involved in that. I can't recall. Maybe it could have been, but I can't recall. I can't recall that. And that Opel time was a tough time for me. Escort was like a glove in my hand, and Escort did whatever I wanted the car to do, and I thought about it, and the car did it. But I never managed to do that with Opel Ascona nor with Manta. And whereas, for example, Henry, who was so fast anyway, Henry fitted into that car very well. And it was a year when I was struggling a little bit. But of course, the highlight was the East African Safari Rally victory, which was a big rally in those days. And I'm happy having not only won it, but generally just done it. And I did it for the first time in 77. It was an incredible experience for a young boy from Finland to go to Africa. And, you know, recce time was maybe 1 month. And what incredible experience. Well, 83, we were in Kalambaka previous evening before coming back to Nairobi at the end of the event. I was seventh or eighth, like 2.5 hours behind the leader. And then during the final night, all those cars in front of me, they fall by wayside for one reason or another. And following day, I find myself as a winner in Safari in Nairobi. So that, of course, gave a lot of lot of satisfaction once I was lucky, you know.
I think it's fascinating to hear that, you know, your experience with the Escon and the Manta, because looking at in Europe or in Britain and Ireland, the Manta was extremely successful. But then it's just, it's funny to contrast. Anytime we'll say a Quattro came over Audi Sport UK to the circuit, it was very rare they actually finished. They always seemed to have trouble, whereas the Manta was able to keep going. But obviously, you know, things totally changed for you then in 84 with the Peugeot, and that was like a return back to something you loved again, a car you loved again. How did that come about?
No, that is very true. I mean, I was back in a car which was really suited me well, and then when a driver is confident, he can do incredible things in his heyday, or rather in a hey moment. I mean, Jean told that he had said it publicly that he wants one out of Marco Allen, Walter Röhl, Henry Toivonen, and myself. He had said one of them. And for some reason, he took me. He took me, and in the beginning, I was warned by, I remember, some British mechanics who were used to work with Talbot and Peugeot, and they warned me, oh, Harry, you mustn't go, that will never work, you know, center engine, four-wheel drive car, and you know what these French people are like, oh, you can't get up with them, and, you know, they take only French soccer provers and French this and French that, and well, I thought, well, I must give the benefit of doubt, and it turned out to be totally, totally different. It was an incredible period. You can ask Timo Salonen, Juha Kankkunen, you can ask anybody who was at Peugeot Talbot Sport in the beginning of Peugeot Talbot. It was just incredible. I mean, everything. I mean, you can find this. It's a British book, 205 book, which was done a few years ago. And I wrote the foreword. And in that foreword, I think I managed to capture what that period meant to me. It was much more than a rallying program. It was incredible human adventure. Well, you know, I very, very nearly died myself during that time. It's a medical miracle that I survived that accident. Some other people died. Christian Taran died. Jackie X's co-driver, some mechanics died. We won everything. We lost everything. And what people don't realize, that Peugeot was about to go belly up at that time, because the car fleet was obsolete, nothing modern. Okay, strong 504, 505, they were strong in the East African Safari Rally, but they were outdated already as a car model. So Peugeot 205 was the first modern car of the new generation. And then Monsieur Boileau, who was the president of Peugeot, he took a big risk because he was not supported by PSA, you know, concern money management, nor by Peugeot family. But they let him, okay, Mr. Boileau, you do it, but it's at your own risk, and it worked out. He took Jean Todt as the boss, Jean took me as a driver, and it worked out incredibly. In the beginning of when we started in Paris, the team was in the middle of Paris. I mean, mechanics were working throughout the night, and Jean Todt would go and buy croissants on Sunday morning and bring that to the mechanics, and we just had that quiet conviction that it will work out, and which was not really based on anything, just on a gut feeling, and it worked out the way. Well, you have to look at what people speak about bike speak or about the Paris-Dakar or whatever. But it was more than a rally program, as I said. Just incredible human adventure. And I'm so happy that more than that, I was part of it. And
You guys basically say Peugeot in a way, as you said. Because
Well, we contributed at least in a big way. Yes, so that's very true. Yes.
Definitely, yeah, because the 205 became, on the back of the rallying success, became one of the most successful small hatchback. And still today, if you see GTI go down the road, it's still probably the most beautiful hatchback you can find still now, you know, 30, 40 years later.
Absolutely. But, and, you know, every day I still see even ordinary 205s coming the other way. I mean, they are incredible still how many of them are left, and particularly, you know, well kept, low mileage 205 GTI. I mean, it fetches.
Fantastic.
Yeah, really, it's a collector's item. But you know, that, and people, I mean, particularly now when I'm most of the time in France, I mean, every day people speak with such a nostalgia about that, that period. And it really captured even national spirit in France. Of course, a lot less events were happening. Internet didn't happen. We didn't have Instagram. I mean, one or two TV channels. And of course, Paris-Dakar, incredible event. Colorful event. After Christmas, when the times are a bit, nothing's happening, it's cold, and people see these very striking pictures and images from Africa, sometimes very dramatic also. And it really captured people's imagination. And would you believe that then in a world championship, if we won something on the following Monday or in the beginning of the week after the rally victory, more white 205s were sold than during any other week. That is to say that unconsciously people bought white, you know, color white 205s after rally victory, because they, because the basic color of the rally 205 Turbo 16 was white. So it was disproportionate number of white 205s were sold after each rally victory, for example. Wow.
Yeah. It makes sense,
Those images haven't faded away. They haven't faded away here. It's just, it's much bigger than a sport. It's just somehow people were in the way in my rally car, if I may say so, in a certain way, or they lived with us. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think looking at that period, and, you know, obviously the Peugeot felt pretty right from the start. There was a lot of very clever engineering went into it. It was a big departure from the Quattro and stuff like that. But you had this period from basically the debut of the car, Corsica 84, up to early 85, where, you know, you were almost untouchable. Five rallies in a row, I think, you know. Aside from the accident in 85, as you mentioned, there's a very, very good chance you would have won the 85 title. So, is that, would you consider that the peak of your driving career, that time period?
Yes, obviously. Yes. I don't know if you looked at my Instagram now. I put a little bit longer story about the Monte Carlo, because Monte Carlo 85, it was like a, as I said, it was like a mini life in itself. Mm. Everything was happening in Monte Carlo, and without that penalty, we would have won the rally by over 13 minutes against Walter by over 13 minutes. Anyway, of course, then we won in Sweden. And then after that, nothing worked out. Nothing at all. Just one finish when I was totally, half paralyzed when I went to New Zealand, because I knew I had to finish in order to keep my world championship hopes alive. And then I finished second there. And after Timo, and then second stage in Argentina, it all stopped. But anyway, that's how life goes. Life is far greater than us. Now I see that accident and how I survived. Well, I have no role. I played no credit. I can't take any credit. But just life is like that. It's you cannot dictate your terms on life. Life will dictate its terms on us. And if I've learned something as a human being, I'm sure I learned from that accident and from that recovery. And because man, after all, he doesn't learn so much from victories. He learns much more from his setbacks. Well, of course, then I had occasional incredible moments after my accident. But of course, I was very close to win a few times World Championship round, but I never won one. But of course, then that Pikes Peak in a way, compensates a lot for that. And of course, those incredible Paris-Dakar victories, and not only victories, but that experience having gone through the poorest countries on part of this of the globe in the four, I think 14 times I did Paris-Dakar, and only in Africa. And you can't imagine what experience that is as a human being. Even you have nothing to do with rally driving, as a human being. Mm. And when I went to Timbuktu, because in those days I had many, you know, in Finnish you have a saying like a Timbuktu is like a far end of the world. Yeah. You have a saying that I go all the way to Timbuktu. That's like the furthest you can go on the globe.
Yeah. My grandfather used to say the same, Ari. He used to say, if you asked him where was he going, if he was going to the farm or to the shop, he would go, I'm just going to Timbuktu. I'll see you tomorrow.
Yeah, exactly
the same. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Just to go somewhere.
I went there several times, and I wrote a love letter to Rita, I think two or three times from there, and once or twice it came all the way back to Finland. But anyway, when you look at the young boy who is standing there in Timbuktu, Timbuktu is, you know, people are living in Timbuktu before they were living in Finland, even people are living in Ireland. And it has been a cultural place, it has been a commercial place, but yet so poor, absolutely the poorest part of the on the face of the earth. And when you see a young boy standing there, and I said to myself, what about if I was born in Timbuktu instead of born in Tupovaara? I didn't choose my parents, nor did you. And that gives you kind of a solidarity. You realize that we have to see a bigger picture in life if we want to survive as a human race. But you also see that how Paris-Dakar, how it gave, although momentarily, but it gave them, it uplifted people from their extremely hard burden they have every day in their lives. And whenever Paris-Dakar on the following year did not go to the same places, people were very, very disappointed, because that gave them even little break, you know, little break in their very, very, very tough life. So Paris-Dakar was, as a whole, as a driver, as a human being, incredible experience. It enriched my life a lot, really a lot.
I'd say it's good to see it, and it's obviously occurring at the moment as well, but it, you know, the event obviously has changed location and stuff over the years. But just before we get on to that in earnest, just a final question for you for the mid-80s period. The way the things were going, did you think it was going to be a tenable situation?
Well, I was because my accident was in the middle of 85, and then I had this incredibly painful 18-month convalescence period, and, you know, physically and mentally painful. And so, of course, you know, 86 was the year of Group B. But it was clear, when you look at the interview of Henry, I think it exists in Finnish, but it exists also in English, when he says just prior to his accident, he just says that, you know, these cars are too fast for my brain. He says, these cars are faster than my brain. That's Henry speaking. And then 2 hours later, he's dead. Mm. So it became unreasonable, and they were very, they were very, they caught fire very, very easily. I don't know. We burnt.
I think I have a photo somewhere of the test car. Yeah, wasn't it in Safari? You burnt the test car or something?
Yes,
like that.
Exactly. We burnt there, and we burnt in that site, and we burnt in
Corsica.
Would you believe in a Baja 1000, Baja 1000 practice in California, and we burnt there one or two cars. Yes, it was. But of course, when you are in it, you don't. '86, I was on the sideline, so I don't really know what the drivers thought. I remember when I went to Henry's funeral in Finland, but of course, I was in the middle of my age sphere at that time, so it was such a surrealistic situation for me. But yeah. it was obvious, as the writing was on the wall, it was obvious that it had to come back to senses. But yet alone, what I said earlier, Group B is something what people still remember, and it has given food for their thoughts and food for their dreams, and so we need, in a way or another, Group B, of course, in a sensible way, but we need entertainment. We need entertainment. We need liberty. And of course, today, if you look at politically, in the name of totally in a false pretext, in the name of saving the world now, you can forbid everything. You know, whatever man does, he's producing CO2. Well, I have been to the poorest countries of the world. There is no CO2, no development, nothing but poverty, nothing but misery, and no perspective for the development, because everything is done by hand. So obviously, if we speak about now the future of our planet, the future is not that we do less, but the future is that we do better. And technology will help us. Then technology will give us the means. We find the new processes, and whatever was needed a little while ago, we don't need it anymore, because we find always a new shortcut in life, and the concept is changing. So we must be positive, but now there's this tendency to do things which are politically correct. Well, it's very dangerous tendency, because how can a government decide that people become happy being politically correct? Because there's no two human beings alike, and we all lead absolutely unique lives, and we are unique persons, each of us. And I always compare it, the human family is like the sea of flowers, and you can never say that there are too many colors. But if you don't water the flowers, and they don't blossom, come on. We need freedom in life, because all the innovation, all the new things, they can, when the people can push the frontiers and they can push the limits, and that gives hope to people. And we need hope, because without hope, man is lost totally. Yeah.
As you've mentioned previously, you went through a very dark period in your life after the accident, and you've been quite brave and quite open about it.
Yeah.
And a lot of people have taken great inspiration from this. How difficult was it for you to get behind the wheel again in 1986, prior to Dakar?
Once I came out of this surrealistic nightmare, once I awoke, because I was totally convinced that I had AIDS, and all the tests were negative. I just told the doctors, well, you are lying to me. Why don't you tell the truth? And I was sure that Rita will die. I was sure that kids would die, because, in my mixed sick mind, I thought, you just hug somebody, you will get AIDS. Because I was totally sick in my mind. And I was explained afterwards. Of course, my accident in Argentina was so massive. It was very similar to the Irish driver, how do you call? Now I lost his Martin, who broke every bone in a Formula accident, but survived.
Martin Donnelly.
Martin Donnelly, yeah, and Dolores.
Exactly,
yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, I was very similar to him. I was just as broken as he was. And then on top of that, I had extreme lack of oxygen in my mind, because my lungs didn't work anymore at all. And it's a medical fact, normally the oxygen level in a man is 97-98%, nearly 100. And some people die when it goes below 50, if the pH level is not right. Well, mine was lowest, was below 20. And to recover from that, and so people were really afraid that my lack of oxygen has created damage in my brain. And well, maybe it did, but it's not very visible. Whatever little I have there, I got it back. And anyway, that was a very dark period in my life. And an incredible thing is, and that's why I was very open first in a medical journal in Finland, I spoke about it, because I realized that the mental, who can say who is healthy mentally? Where is a line? Who is healthy, who is not? That line is drawn on water. And, you know, I was in that totally insane fear and nothing would get me out of it. And then somehow my brother-in-law, who was also a helicopter pilot, Rita's brother, he managed to convince me to come to see the Thousand Lakes, because at that time, that was 86 Thousand Lakes, year after my accident, because I was doing a little bit better at that time. So I took all my Valium sedating tablets and all with me, and Ralle said, my brother-in-law, that, well, we will not see any people, because I couldn't face any people. So we just walk in a stop, land in the middle of the forest, and you will be okay. And said, okay, I finally accepted to come with him. In fact, we flew to the Rantasipi Hotel where the Thousand Lakes is held, which had been my home for during 1 month every summer. And the helicopter is still 1 meter off the ground. The skids hadn't touched the ground yet. And awake from this nightmare, which had lasted for 9 months at least, I realized, no, what crazy thing. Of course I don't have any AIDS. I awake. I mean, we all of us nightmares. And when you have a bad nightmare, I mean, you take a deep breath, because when you awake and you realize, oh, it was only a nightmare. Well, I awoke, you know, million times strong away from nightmare. And I realized, well, I'm not going to die. And from then on, I mean, my legs started to work a little bit already. So a few weeks later, I was already testing a little bit of car. And a couple of months later, I was already able to drive in a test in Sahara for the Paris-Dakar. And all that AIDS thing has never come back to my mind. Never, ever. It was suddenly behind me. And I saw the life in its right lights, in the real lights. And it was obvious that I came back, because you cannot drive competitively unless you are totally, it's natural. It's like you are thirsty and you take a glass of water. But it was still in my mind, like a lingering doubt that, you know, am I still fast enough? Because, okay, I did Dakar. And of course, start line of Dakar was like a second life starting, because now when you know what had happened in my life, then I was there at the start line in the middle of Paris. I had to, is it really me that this life, which I thought was all behind me, in fact, I'm alive, my family's alive, I'm back in the rally. And then we win this event. So I always say that highlight of my life was just when people say, what is your biggest experience in your entire career? I said the start line of Paris-Dakar 87. That's life number two starts. And of course, victory was that. Well, that was a nice bonus. But anyway, Paris-Dakar doesn't prove that you are as fast as, you know, the fastest rally driver. Then I did East African Safari in some totally awful little Subaru Leonia, whatever it's called. I'm a horrible little car. I'm sorry, Subaru, but I'm Subaru people would agree with me.
It wasn't as good as the Legacy or the Impreza. Let's just put it that
Legacy,
way.
Legacy was a light year better than
that. Yeah.
Anyway, so then we come. My first proper test is Pikes Peak 87. And we go to do our private test. First, we hire the hill. And I'm all the time slower than the times of Walter Röhrl from previous year, because we knew his times. I'm considerably like a second a kilometer slower all the time. We do our mornings, our private mornings. Then we do the official test, because Walter was there then with me. So we have this three test mornings where everybody starts when the competitors are split into three groups, and you do the first third of the hill, middle third, or the final third. And on three mornings, you have covered the whole road. And then fourth morning, qualifying, and you do half of the hill, 10 kilometers. And then this incredible mechanic, we have engineer, Jean-Claude Vocard, this little Harry Potter kind of gentleman with the glasses, very discreet guy. But he saved us. I mean, I just spoke to him again at length a couple of days ago. Fantastic engineer who had done rallying with Simca Tau Mill in his younger days. Anyway, and so we're all the time much slower than Walter Röhrl. And I was saying to myself, well, that must be because of that incredible lack of oxygen I had in my brains during the accident and afterwards. So I'm not anymore the old Ari, you know. I'm not so sharp anymore. I'm blunt. I'm the version Ari blunt. And final night before the qualifying, Jean-Claude gets the fantastic idea. He obliged the mechanics because everybody was very tired because we had been got up so early every morning and very long days. So he obliged them to work throughout the night. And he, as you see in the photos for 87 qualifying, he puts the second spoiler on the back, behind the second rear spoiler. And no testing, nothing, of course, straight into the start line, straight into the, they got it ready in the morning, straight into the start line, woof, flag up and I'm qualifying. After 2-3 corners, I realized car is transformed. And that gave me wings because when I feel car is good, I became a secondary, you know, and I was flying the stage, that 10 kilometers. Walter was in front of me. I come to the restaurant. There's a restaurant at the midway, you know, at 10 kilometer mark. I see the Walter's time. So instead of being like I was expecting to be 4 or 5 seconds slower, I think I was 4 seconds faster than Walter. I was in my tears and I cried, or I not cried, but I was in my tears. I had tears in my eyes because that is in the backdrop of what had happened, 85 Argentina, all that recovery, all that incredible period that I survived somehow, not thanks to me. But then I had this flingering doubt that, well, Ari is blunt, not anymore. I don't have the same capacity. And there I realized, yes.
Still there.
I'm still. And Keith Oswin, if you remember, the only journalist who was there was Keith Oswin, who was a longtime autosport journalist.
Yeah.
Keith Oswin. He was there. And now I haven't met Keith for years. But, you know, I've still seen him after that, he said, you know, he remembers that. He said, I should have had the camera. But so, you know, you have moments like that in life. Yeah, you have incredible gratefulness. You thank Lord. Well, I'm here. I'm alive. Yes, I'm just as fast as I used to be, despite everything, despite the lack of oxygen, whatever. So it's just, but it's not that how good you are. It's just the incredible gratefulness what life has given to you. Incredible gratefulness, incredible sense of humility also, that everything is a big gift in your life. And and then you must put it into make the most of it.
Pike's Peak must have been such a phenomenal challenge. You know, obviously it still is, but back then, you know, you'd come from rallying and obviously the raids and stuff like that, but you'd had the pace notes and at least some idea, whereas this was like Group B Unlimited in terms of the cars. Yeah, I mean, that 405 was just
gold. I mean, our glass was called Unlimited. It was,
yeah.
Our class was called unlimited.
Like what power was that 405? 650, 700 horsepower?
It was slightly over 600, 610, 620, 630, something like that. And the real weight was a slightly under 900 kilos. So, let's say 900 kilos. So, let's say acceleration from 0 to 200 was much less than 10 seconds. Of course, four-wheel drive, four-wheel steering. Yes, fantastic beast. Beast with my capital letters.
And when you get near the top, obviously, you know, Pike's Peak, now it's full tarmac all the way up, but back then it was a mixture still. So
it was not mixture, it was gravel, 100% gravel.
Was there no tarmac at any point on the road?
Not an inch. No,
wow.
100% gravel. Wow. No, 87, 88, 89. They only after 89, I don't know if it was 90, but anyway. Over 3 years, not a single meter of tarmac.
Wow. And so coming to the top, you're the real, real fresh air bins. Like, did at any stage, does the brain kind of say, okay, maybe I lift the right foot a small bit, or is it just...
No, but it's natural. It's not, you know, we are not, none of us, even the fastest of us, we are not superhumans. You do things you feel comfortable with. And of course, sometimes we get wings. Like in that 80, 85 in Monte Carlo, going back to now what I wrote in Instagram, or it's in my book, you know. Mm. One special stage, San Nasser, changed everything. You know, previous stage, Monte Carlo was Bourget, 45 kilometer long, difficult conditions, and I thought I had done no mistakes. And Walter was 6 seconds faster on 45 kilometers. It's not a lot, but I said to Terry Harriman, look at, Walter is going to have his fifth victory in Monte Carlo. He's a maestro. And then on the following stage, I got some new tires and some incredible grip, and I got wings, and I just flew. And I on the 22 kilometers, I beat him by 27 seconds. And he was second fastest on 22 kilometers. That's one of my three best, if not the best, personal stages in my life. Anyway, it was a watershed, 85 Monte Carlo. And after that was untouchable, totally different, Ari, untouchable. And, yeah. And then we come to Gap. I'm leading by about 3 minutes. Okay, then we clock in, 4 minutes too early, get 8 minute penalty. Well, anyway. But there are moments like that in life that you really fly, like that qualifying when you get the second wing, and then the Pikes Peak as a whole. Yes, it was. But you are not the superhuman when you do, even if there are no drops, no guardrails or nothing, because you feel comfortable in that car. Had that car been difficult to drive, no way I could have pushed the limits, because you feel that you are not on the top of it. But when you really, when it's like a glove in your hand, I mean, you are leading an orchestra. You are maestro of the orchestra. And car does, you think, and car will do it. Yeah. And that's how that car was. So, and of course, actually, the real rally, when you look at the YouTube, you find it. On the Pikes Peak film was done when it was famous climb dance,
yeah.
And then with a lift in the hand, and it becomes quite a saying in France that you can always in life you can lift your hand but not your foot, you know.
Yeah, that's
what you need to apply whatever you are doing as an engineer or nurse or whatever. So that you give your best what you do in life. You give your best. Anyway, actual race was done on a hailstone. We had the race was stopped prior our depart for a couple of hours, and we waited. Did you realize we waited for hailstones to melt? You need to go to YouTube. You will find the footage, and the actual rally at the race 88, and consequently my record was 10 kilometers was dry first 10 kilometers. Then from that restaurant onwards, when you have no more forest, you have the steep drops. It was all muddy. It was all muddy. And you can imagine what the conditions are like. Afterwards, I had Juha Kankkunen, my teammate. And afterwards, we realized that at the restaurant, after 10 kilometer mark, he was 1/100th of a second faster. We didn't have any times into our head because we didn't have any telephones and that was not allowed. But anyway, but afterwards we saw he was 1/100th of a second faster after 10 kilometers, then started the hailstones over the mud. And of course, then it takes, but I still felt comfortable in that car, in the mud, even with that power and those tires. And so I managed to improve Walter Röhrl's record, but only by half a second because of these adverse conditions. And also in the YouTube, you find there's a footage at the start line when Zantot asked me, well, what tires do you want for a hill? So I said, I take hard tires, but obviously I knew what it meant. And I said, in any case, we can't make the record now because it's all 10 kilometers mud, but we managed to make the record by half a second. And then Juha was something like 4 seconds slower than me on that remaining 10 kilometers. And then 89, which was our very final year, I was a few kilometers before coming to the summit. I was already something like 15 seconds below my last year's, previous year's time, because it was dry, of course, makes all the difference. But unfortunately, I slid a little bit wide but not on the side of emptiness, but side of the rock. And I had the puncture, and we never saw, and I, so I didn't, so I could have in theory improved the record by 20 seconds, but then I didn't, and we never went there afterwards. So that's it.
The 205 had evolved to the 405, like you say, from in Pikes Peak 87 through to 88 and 89. And likewise, it did the same for Parry Dakar, which you've won four and a half times.
Four and a half.
The first year was dramatic, to say the least, but the year of the half, that we'll call it, in 88, that was in the 405, the Grand Raid. That was very dramatic, also with Juha.
Yes, of course. Where else can it happen? I mean, we know that it's not a proper Parc Fermé. It was a big, like a football stadium in Bamako, the capital of Mali. And we had no controls. I mean, lots of people, everybody saw that car going out like at 3 o'clock in the morning. Our mechanics had stopped working maybe 2 o'clock in the morning. An hour later, car just goes out. But everybody thought when the mechanics are going to test drive my car, but in fact, it was stolen. And they called Jean Todt and asked for ransom. And Jean Todt went to a meeting, but never found these guys. But then we found a car, because it's impossible to hide such a car. But then I was late at the start line and made an appeal. And it was just a day before I'm to Dakar, our appeal was rejected. And so that was a half a victory, but anyway, it's just it can only happen in Dakar. And those people actually there were some mercenaries who wanted they had some murky operation in Africa, and they wanted to have some finance, and so they stole the car to get the money.
So some of the most amazing stories come out of Dakar, and there's a video on YouTube that it's of obviously the trucks entering Dakar, and it's of you driving along in the desert along a straight. And I think Jan de Roy in the DAF. All I can think about is here's Ari Vatanen, absolutely flat out in the 405. And what must he be thinking seeing this DAF truck pulling up alongside? It was crazy.
But you know, they had 2,000. They had two engines in DAFs, 2,000 brake horse engines. And I suppose I could have gone, but it's because when you are leading by a lot, I mean, you don't have to push. And anyway, it's very dangerous in Sahara. You know, in a certain kind of roads, when it's bumpy and certain bumps, and lorry with the big wheels can ride over the bumps much safer than 2 or 405 or 205, because we had that tendency, like what happened to me in Argentina, that, you know, flipping over, you know, end over end. So in Sahara you have to be very, very careful for that. So you better let the lorry to drive the same speed and have accident. But anyway, that takes nothing away. I mean, those lorries were very fast. But that had the tragic consequences, because they later on they had an accident, and a co-driver, because there were seat belts were bolted onto seat, not onto the chassis, and it came because when they had an accident, the co-driver was thrown out of the cockpit, the seat fixing, the seat installation broke off. And because his seat belts were bolted onto the seat, not onto the body, the chassis. So with the seat belts intact, he flew with the seat out of the DAF and he died. And so, you know, it's Dakar is a very tragic event. So many tragedies I saw there over the years.
I think, as you mentioned earlier on, your safari experience probably helped to contribute. But looking at this, you know, your career to date, we'll say, there's been so much variety. The Group 4 days into Group B, where the cars became suddenly twice as powerful. Then on to something totally different again, the Dakar, the Pikes Peak. then I suppose back in the late 80s to early 90s again, you found yourself at the forefront of Group A rallying, and you know, dealing with the new breed of driver, the likes of Colin McRae and stuff like that. What was the second, I guess, run as a factory rally driver like for you?
Obviously, you want to do normal, ordinary rallies because that's your first love, and that's the drive. That's the driving at its poorest form, and so we had some fantastic events and some fantastic performances occasionally, a little bit up and down. Very often due to my own mistakes. So old Ari was still very much alive with his mistakes, and but we had some fabulous times with even Mitsubishi. You know, I was really competitive on certain events when we got the Gallant was a very heavy car. We had even in Monte Carlo, we were doing very well. And the final night, I touched the brake pedal and the accelerator at the same time and went into rock face. And that was the end of it. We nearly won the Thousand Lakes against Carlos Sainz. It was 1919 or Gallant. It was quite an achievement. And with all the due credit, when Timo Salonen got my Mitsubishi, he got absolutely nowhere. And yet Timo was really fast. And when he inherited my car, he got absolutely nowhere in that car. So obviously I still was quite a good driver. Then Subaru, of course, with Impreza particularly, we were very, very close to win the Thousand Lakes in 93. And some also really beautiful times in Australia. So it was a time I enjoyed a lot. I mean, of course, it would have been nice to win one event, but no regrets on that. And of course, I was clock was beginning to work against me. You know, the 40 plus drivers, they are not particularly very much wanted. But of course, I remember I still had that. I kept on writing letters to Ford and everybody, you know, please give me a chance. You know, let me do full championship still once, and I can still do it. It was a good combination. I did world championship and African rallies. Yeah.
You mentioned obviously you're kind of coming to the latter end of your career, and you're joining in the Group A days, and a lot has been made and a lot has been documented about the years of Colin McRae coming into Subaru and your influence on him, and obviously he was very openly a big fan of yours. How do you think that relationship developed, and how much influence did you think you had on Colin?
No, that's hard to judge that. But obviously unfortunately we had you know, same kind of qualities. You know, Colin should have looked at me and say, well, you know, I don't learn from Ari. You know, Ari is teaching how not to do it. And when he came to our very first testing in Wales, I said to Colin, well, come and as my co-driver, I will show you a thing or two. And we had a big off. We rolled the car. Legacy, and we had to call it to end the service test session. David Richards was not very happy, but that's for sure. I took Colin for drive, and we rolled down the hill in Wales, and that was the end of a test session. And but I had a good time with him. Colin was, well, as we all know, he was, of course, in a way, all the due credit, a little bit spoiled boy, but because driving was absolutely everything to him, and whatever he did was very, very natural. I don't think I could teach him anything. You know, I often said the only thing I maybe could teach him if I went to a fish restaurant in Nice, I said not to order hamburger here. You know, you need to eat fish. You know,
yeah. that's one of those famous
that kind of advice.
Yeah. I think I remember that. I can't remember which DVD that was on, where one of the McRae years, and something, it's a line I've always remembered. It's why I kind of came into my head about, Joe, you know, you're teaching him that you don't order hamburger and chips and you leave your shorts behind.
No, exactly. Come, you know, dressed decently and don't order hamburger.
Just, I suppose, Ari, looking at that, if you want to say the frontline career, you had your final drives with Ford in 98 and then the rally with Subaru and GB in 98 and stuff. Your career spanned, you know, probably the most exciting, all the most exciting parts of the sport, For, like, if you had to pick, I don't know, two or three guys throughout that period that you would have classed as your biggest rivals, who would they be?
It's hard. We always, I see people as unique individuals, and I may, you know, have a respect from them regardless of their driving. So I look at them as a human beings. For example, regarding Formula One drivers, I mean everybody is a fan of Ayrton Senna, but so am I, because his personality touched me, not only driving, but if I look at my, there are so many. I mean, I start from Hannu Mikkola, Hannu, because he was my hero in the beginning. Then we had big fights with Markku Alén, particularly on the thousand lakes. Björn Valdegård was somebody who I respected a lot as a person, as a driver. The younger ones. How should I say? I don't know. It's very hard to me name. I refuse to say, because it's in a way unfair to name any persons. They all. What matters to me is that I lived in a period when we had lots of different drivers, lots of different characters, and we had time to get to know each other. You know, we were in Acropolis Rally, we go to Aster Beach. We all had young families at that time. We were all in front of bungalows with wives, and small kids were on the lawn. That's what matters to me. All of them merit to be on the podium. You know, in the physically or in your mind.
It's a very diplomatic answer, but I totally understand what you're saying. Because it might be easier to answer what was your favorite car from your career.
Escort and Peugeot, and if I just do it one car, then it's of course Peugeot 205.
Yeah.
As the car and as the period and as that experience. So yes, those two cars. Impreza, I liked Impreza also a lot.
Yeah. Because
that suited me well. But that's right. Those three cars. I drove Porsche 11 once in a circuit race in as a guest driver in Porsche Cup in Estoril. I hated every second. Porsches are the best cars technically, but 911, at least at that time in early 90s, horrible car to drive.
That's so nice.
You can't go sideways, and you just spins around, and I can't. I need a car which is a progressive, and I can have it if it's, you know, forgives my mistake and I can recover it.
Yeah.
Is there any car that you wish you had a chance to drive, Ari?
I had a contract. David Richards made a good contract with Mercedes. I was in the Finnish army at that time, 80, 81. And we never drove. We got paid. We got paid and we never drove one. We had a contract for East African Safari Rally and Ivory Coast. And so that big Mercedes, we had a contract and got paid, but never drove. But otherwise, no, I can't think either. I've tried Audi would not have been my car at all. Fiat Mirafiori would not have been my car. No, I had a wide variety of cars.
Yeah, some amazing cars. Drives in some of them, because even we were looking at some of the footage of in 87 in the Sierra in Thousand Lakes. Yes. You know, a car that really was not ideal for the conditions, but you know,
I still did one, even 87,000 legs. I did one fast this time in Sierra on the stage, which was very fast and no slow corners. So even with rear wheel drive Sierra, you could, I had one fastest time. And of course, that was my first event in Finland after my accident, which had happened 2 years earlier. And Sierra was very noisy car because of the rear wheel spinning all the time. I remember when I did the first test, 87. And of course, I was used to drive a four-wheel drive car. I said to engineers, well, the transmission is broken, you know, it doesn't move, you know. It's just spinning wheels and makes plenty of noise, you know. I hear the stones are hitting body cell, but this is a car, it's not moving, you know. But there's nothing wrong with the car. I was already used to a four-wheel drive car. And anyway, so that car made a lot of noise with the rear wheel spinning. But despite our helmets and headsets, I could hear occasionally when people were, you know, applauding or just shouting on a special stage, just not how fast I go, but, you know, Ari is still alive, Ari is back. I could hear people applauding, you know, on a special stage while I drive. I could hear them screaming, kind of, Ari is back, Ari is alive. Fantastic. Yeah.
Does it, for reasons like that, would Finland probably be your favorite event, or would you have anything ahead of that? Dakar, no.
It's a biased. Well, it's a favorite event in that sense that when you're in front of your home crowd with the Finnish traditions and so much is expected from you and no excuses, and you are against other Finnish boys. I mean, that's the only event where I have to go to toilet, toilet every 2 minutes before a start. Yeah, so in that sense, there's more at stake in Finland. Yeah. But it can be any rally, any nice rally, nice stages. And of course, competition makes what the event is all about. When you have a tough fight with somebody, you know, then you remember that event. So it can be any event.
Mm. Yeah. What I was looking, we've covered Aldo briefly, because we could probably spend a week talking to you, Ari, and yeah, still not get every story. But we've covered, you know, the time period of your career. Looking the way you look at the sport now, how do you feel things are currently? Do you follow it closely? Do you kind of take a step back and just watch occasionally? Or because I actually met you at Col de Tirreni last year. Maybe you landed in the helicopter and we went over and we said hello and stuff like that. So I know you still attend the events and stuff, but what's your thoughts on the current state of the sport?
That's my favorite part of the year is to come there, you know, how your helicopter land in that place. And it is, that is one of the highlights of my year. Yeah. And also that partly because I've been there since I did the ice notes for Timo Mäkinen in 1976, when I just was appointed by Stuart Turner, and my first job was with Tony Armstrong. Tony Armstrong used to be a co-driver of Rauno Aaltonen. So Tony Armstrong was my co-driver and we did ice notes for Timo Mäkinen, and I stayed in that hotel. So that's why those places are very dear to me. But what do I say currently? I don't know. Being politically correct can be bad for the sport. I sincerely think that, you know, because rally is all about entertainment. So we should go back to rear-wheel drive cars only. Just have rear-wheel drive cars. Rear-wheel drive cars would be much cheaper and would be really good value for money for the spectators, and plenty of sideways, and all the, you know, flies would be on the side windows and you see the side numbers first when the car is coming. Well, that's what sport is all about. I don't know about the new, I don't even know what the new rules are precisely going to be like. I gather with these hybrid models, they are very expensive. It's a very political concept. But if the rallying is too expensive, like any form of motorsport, it will be then left for happy few only.
I think we agree on that, Ari. I think we're firm believers of naturally aspirated rear-wheel drive and noise. That's motorsport.
Exactly. Totally agree.
Yeah. And do you still, Joe, does the passion, I guess, still, do you still feel the urge to be competitive, or has that kind of waned? You know, you still feel the urge to get into a car and drive the way you do?
Yeah, driving wise, yes, but absolutely without the stopwatch, because people always, why don't you do an old car rally? Why don't you? I say, come on. I have seen everything. And when I did it, there was a reason why I did it. It made sense. You know, you're in a championship. It's your contract. It's your livelihood. But particularly, it's your sport. And it makes sense because you are fighting for a victory. But then now in my age, what is the point to start doing rallies again? Because, you know, you must also, mustn't forget that, you know, you can have even a historic car rally. I know my tendency. I could get carried away and then if I had an accident now, I mean, that would be the most foolish thing to do. So, but driving-wise, you know, I do still a lot of driving in Lapland, in that MS Drive school, and then a lot of BMW track days I do in France. And so whenever I have an opportunity to go sideways, no, it's like old Ari takes over, but no stopwatch. Thank you.
Yeah.
You've become a video star, obviously, with Climb Dance and the famous Manx video where you and Terry go through the cattle grid.
Oh, dear.
But another favorite video of ours is the Vatten and Touch 2. And the question I think a lot of us are asking is, have you improved at golf?
How not to? This is not name dropping, but, you know, I used to, you know, Nick Faldo used to come to, we used to see in, he came to Backshot. Because do you remember? It was in near London, the place called Backshot.
Yeah.
Do you know? It was an army.
You lived in Cookham Dean.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's right.
Everyone.
There's one. Now, Neil name dropping. We had one lunch because Chris Rea was living, the singer, he was living nearby. So we had one lunch when Chris Rea came to our house and Nick Faldo. Well, I've lost the trace of Chris now, but after like maybe 15 years not having had heard of Nick, now we are quite regularly, we call with Faldo and actually he came to Lapland this year, 2020, he came to Rovaniemi, to our school January 2020, so I'm in touch with him, but we talk about driving, we don't talk about golf. so I haven't played golf. No, the answer is it would be terrible, my swing would be terrible.
Different
it's easier for me to teach Nick to learn to drive than the other way around.
Yeah. If we could also, if anyone has one of those Subaru jumpers, the pink jumper, I think they'd be worth a few pounds at this point.
Are they on sale on eBay?
I don't know. We'll have to find. I actually recently purchased a 555 Subaru jacket from the 90s. So it's getting to the stage now where that stuff is, you know, it's retro and it's worth a few money. So, but if anyone has one,
if you one, Ari, it's an extra pension money, you know.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Okay. Very good.
Thank you so much for coming on. We also have to give a special shout out to Pat Caulfield and Joe Connolly of Red Mills who put us in contact with you. But like to us and to, I think, rallying folk in Ireland in general. And all over the world. We have listeners all over the world. Ari Vatten is one of the biggest names in the sport, one of the biggest heroes. So we are totally honored to have you on with us. So thank you very, very much for joining us and for giving us your Sunday afternoon.
No sweat at all. No, thank you for keeping up what you are doing in Ireland. And as I said, you know, I've got really sincerely good souvenirs from the early part, and the early part souvenirs are the best. So, and it's very good that you are keeping up the rallying spirit in Ireland. So,
yeah,
happy new year and just keep at it flat out.
Definitely flat out. And I think just to finish off, we'll cheers to Ari. We all have a glass of milk.
Yeah,
so,
that's a glass of milk.
Very good.